London, in Paris,
Morocco,
Cairo,
in Mexico City.
Join us here at The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. President Obama heads overseas this week to Asia. He hopes to strengthen U.S. economic ties with that region. Part of his agenda is a new trade agreement. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it involves the U.S. and 11 other countries, notably not China. We're joined now by two experts to tell us what this means for American interests and American workers. Our guests are Sudeep Reddy, economics editor at The Wall Street Journal, and Robin Farzad, host of the forthcoming business podcast, Full Disclosure. Welcome, both of you.
Hi, Celeste.
Thank you.
Sudeep, first give us the basics. What are the basics of this particular trade deal?
For several years, the Obama administration has been working with these countries that border the Pacific and in trying to create greater trade ties. A dozen countries, Australia, Singapore, the United States, Chile, Japan. The goal is to create links between these countries to bring down tariffs, to bring down what it costs to get products into some of these countries, and to forge stronger trade ties so products are moving back and forth in a freer fashion. And as you noted, one of the big goals in this is to create ties in a place where there is already a big powerhouse. China is the second largest economy in the world after the United States, and it is showing its might in a lot of ways. And a lot of smaller countries in the around Asia are concerned about China's strength. And this is one way, by creating economic ties between the United States and some of these countries, to serve as a counterweight to China's big force in that region.
So, Robin, who are the fors and againsts? Oftentimes in trade deals, we see big business pitted against workers and labor unions, right? Is that the case in the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
No, in this case, these are really de minimis agreements in the grand scheme of things. As Sudeep said, the big player there is China.
Did you say de minimis?
De minimis. I always wanted to use that term on public radio,
well,
too.
Well, you
I
mean, just did.
Thank you. Thank
bucket
you for
list,
the privilege.
Okay.
That's on my bucket list. You're talking about Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and Philippines, and they're by no means monolithic. But again, what is in common here is the way they're looking at China, especially in the lens of what's gone on recently with Russia and the Ukraine. And the U.S., the White House, is hard-pressed to transmit to affect the fact that it's still strong and important regionally. So it's looking around the world. It's saying, well, we're not being looked at as being very efficacious now in Europe. So let's go to Asia, especially where there's this possibility that China might be emboldened to rough up the likes of South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines, and reassert the fact that we are preeminently important to these countries in terms of the economic ties. So it's a delicate balancing act for our trade representatives and for the White House at the same time to kind of thumb our noses at China and reassert our kind of geostrategic and trade importance to these smaller countries.
Well, you are efficacious at using sophisticated words like de minimis there, Robin.
I'm still bitter over the SAT verbal, and I remember the six words that I missed. So, of course, I haven't gotten over it.
He's trying to get them all in this segment.
Yes.
So, Deep, if I'm an average auto parts manufacturer, line worker, right, do I have something to fear from this Trans-Pacific Partnership? Is it going to cost the United States jobs?
We don't even know how this agreement is going to end up, and that's one of the concerns that's coming up among workers, among businesses, among lawmakers in all of this. The goal in this kind of a trade agreement is to create more open trade so that an auto worker here can get his or her parts to be sold all over the world and maybe free that up a little bit. But anyone who has watched the last two decades of global trade since NAFTA in the early 1990s, it's obviously been a big political issue. But you can see the benefits and the drawbacks of all of these trade agreements, and there are going to be benefits and drawbacks on both of them, where in some cases you've seen a lot of the benefits accrue to regular people, being able to access products that are cheaper, access services that are cheaper. It's a much different world than it was two decades ago in terms of technology and communications. All of that is changing, and we have a system right now that is stuck in a different era. And that's what people are looking at and wondering, if we go forward with this, is it going to be a loss to me and my company and my neighborhood, or is it going to be some kind of a benefit in ways that I'm not imagining right now?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the economic agenda of President Obama's trip to Asia. And our guests are Sudeep Reddy, you just heard, of the Wall Street Journal, and business journalist Robin Farzad. A few Democrats are opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this trade agreement. Take a listen to Representative Rosa DeLauro last week.
It threatens to roll back financial regulation, environmental standards, and U.S. laws that protect the safety of drugs and food and the toys that we give to our kids.
Robin, what do we know about things like that she just mentioned, whether or not it holds nations that are in this trade agreement to certain economic standards, financial standards, environmental standards?
These are evergreen concerns. You had them with NAFTA. You had them with China over its accession to the WTO. For example, Colombia's free trade agreement with the United States ran afoul of labor unions here. There are always things that you could bring up. In this case, this is much more, to my mind, about the signaling of what this sends to China, really at the nexus of national security and economic relations than it is about the fine details of, well, what are tariffs, X, Y, and Z? I mean, the press really isn't even focusing on that. In each case here, each of these countries, Japan, Malaysia, the Philippines, and South Korea, each has a dispute with China over at least one island. And the Chinese Coast Guard recently harassed Filipino ships. And the idea here is that if China is emboldened by the state of affairs from the Kremlin vis-a-vis the Ukraine, that it could get more aggressive with these countries. And they just want to be assured. It's more about photo op diplomacy and Obama going there and shaking hands, that they have a foil to China, that Washington and Wall Street and the United States has their back if China were to get more aggressive.
There are some real concerns here about the underlying provisions, the regulations that lawmakers are talking about.
Especially considering some of the product problems and recalls that we've had and safety concerns.
Exactly. And you've seen these in markets all over the world. And if these trade deals end up being lowest common denominator approaches, you might end up reducing some of the requirements that you have for American products. That's the fear. The goal of a trade deal is to bring up all these other countries and force them to use higher environmental regulations, better labor standards, better product standards for food, for prescriptions, for all these things. And that's the goal of the negotiation. But all the other countries, particularly these countries, aren't there yet in terms of their own markets. And so they don't want to lose out by coming together in this way. And that's the tension you have here. It's the tension you have in any trade agreement around the world, is who is going to come up and who's going to come down in their standards and in their requirements, and are they going to lose out on some of what they have right now in terms of product
and
services.
Just convinced that the ancillary goals here are actually very important, especially in the context of, I don't want to beat on the Ukraine drum too much, but it's really what everybody is talking about here. And each of these countries has their peculiar concerns, peculiar vested interests with the United States, and individual details to hammer out. Japan and South Korea, for example, are not considered emerging markets. South Korea has ascended. I mean, it's totally turned its act around in the past 17 years. Malaysia and the Philippines are kind of more on the frontier. Malaysia has issues with democracy. There are people here in the United States that are saying we should not legitimize the regime so much by having Obama be the first president in decades to visit over there. So there are all sorts of things that are going into this.
That's Robin Farzad there. Sudeep, you mentioned NAFTA earlier, and certainly that was the trade deal signed under the Clinton administration. And there were many things, unintended, unforeseen things, that sort of trickled down from that trade agreement. What do you think we've learned from NAFTA, and is any of that going to translate into this trade deal?
We've certainly learned that people generally are not in love with trade deals. When you talk to Americans, they understand a lot of the benefits that you get from trade deals, because you can see people down the street, you can see your coworkers, you can see your neighbors, people in your communities going and selling their products to other countries, and that can be a benefit. But you also see the famous Ross Perot giant sucking sound, jobs leaving the country. You have to question, though, in this era of technology, a lot of these jobs would have left anyway. There are always opportunities for companies around the world.
Right, but would we have lost the manufacturing sector to the extent that we did?
Would we have lost it at the pace we lost it and the way we did, exactly, is the question. But we are always going to be dealing with that, particularly when we're getting better and better products being built. And we demand, as consumers, we demand that they're cheaper products whenever possible. And so there's a tension here in what Americans want from their products and what they want in terms of prices. And when you go to the store, you're typically going for the cheaper price products.
Yeah.
But you also want the jobs. And the administration, every administration wants to figure out how to not only preserve jobs, but more importantly, figure out what the next set of jobs will be. And that's what the goal of these trade agreements really is to expand the opportunity for businesses. Because if you look at the figures right now, about 1% of American companies actually export anything. And there's a huge gap between what the American economy gets from exports and what our big competitors like China and Germany get from exports.
So, Robin, NAFTA obviously took a very, very long time to be finalized. What about this particular trade pact? What's the chances it'll actually go through, and what's our timeline?
The administration doesn't have many friends who are in control of Congress right now, but it has people who want to be friends with it, friends in need in a moment of potential China being able to puff its chest more. So this could theoretically be fast-tracked. Japan and South Korea are most critical here in terms of key exports that come to the United States. If you think about all the products that you have, Samsung TVs, LG phones, right, from South Korea, it's really arrived as a major economic powerhouse. So if this is focused, if he could get some unanimity among these very different economies, then it doesn't have to take that long. But I question this idea that this would really accelerate these countries espousing full democracy through free trade, especially in the case of Malaysia. If you look at China since the WTO in 2001, 2002, it has not been the case.
Okay, that's Robin Farzad. Sorry, I have to leave that debate for another time. He's host of the upcoming business podcast, Full Disclosure, joined us from Richmond, Virginia. And Sudeep Reddy is an economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. He was here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Celeste.
Thank you.
Coming up, there's been an increase in the number of stay-at-home moms in the United States. That's according to a new report from the Pew Research Center.
What we've seen is an uptick in the share of stay-at-home moms who say they're there not because they're caring for home and family, but because they can't find a job.
That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our region features a remarkable number of talented musicians playing almost countless types of acoustic music, as well as artists in the realms of theater and dance. Live and Local lets you know who's playing where and when, with good conversation, great music, recordings by local artists, and frequent live performances in our studio. We broadcast the show 5 days a week at 4 p.m., just before All Things Considered. Please join me for Live and Local, only on FM 90.9.
WILL programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2014 series presents Expanding Opportunities in Africa, the Next Einstein Initiative, by Neil Turok, Monday, April 21st at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. This spring, along with NPR's Morning Edition, we're helping you navigate the higher education money maze with our Paying for College series. We've heard about how college got so expensive and how families and students are taking on massive loans to pay for it. But today we want to talk more about an effort to make college not just affordable, but free.
The Tennessee Promise is an ongoing commitment to every student, from every kindergartner to every high school senior. We will promise that he or she can attend 2 years of community college or a college of applied technology absolutely free.
That was Governor Bill Haslam announcing the Tennessee Promise at his State of the State address earlier this year. Tennessee lawmakers greenlit the plan last week, and the state plans to implement it in 2015. Here to give us more information, Richard Rota. He's the executive director of the state's Higher Education Commission. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Celeste, thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
First, you know, I wondered if you could comment on why this got such strong support from so many lawmakers and such an overwhelmingly positive vote on this. How did this particular plan become so popular?
Governor Haslam took this on as a cause, and this was very much a part of his agenda. What you heard from his State of the State address, by the way, I was one of those cheering at the time. But it was clear that this is something he saw as important to the state of Tennessee and not just a higher education initiative, but one that everyone needed to embrace. He got buy-in early on. He named a special advisor for higher education who served for a year crossing the state, talking with not only educators, but the business community, the nonprofit sector, to talk about the need to increase the educational attainment of the state. And that's what the Tennessee Promise is about, and it's part of the overall umbrella of a drive to 55. So in the year 2025, 55% of adult Tennesseans will have some kind of post-secondary credential.
How does it work? Does a student have to maintain a certain GPA? I mean, what kind of requirements does it call for before you get your community college 2-year tuition paid?
Right. No additional requirements beyond being admitted and remaining in good standing. There are requirements, however, and this is a defining characteristic, that you would agree to have a mentor, someone who will guide you through the process of applying for financial aid, applying for admission, and making sure you, the student, meet all the deadlines. And there's also a very modest community service obligation. But that's it. There's nothing beyond good standing and being admitted.
Why do they need financial aid if tuition is free?
Well, financial aid goes beyond tuition and fees. There are cost of attendance issues, books, living allowance for some students. So, again, the characteristic of this program, a student is encouraged to and is required to fill out the FAFSA, which is the application form for all need-based aid, both federal, like the Pell Grant, and then we have a state need-based program, as well as the lottery scholarship. So the student first receives all that financial aid for which he or she may be eligible, and then where the Tennessee Promise comes in is the last dollar. If there's still a gap between other forms of financial aid and total tuition and fees.
Although to pay for this plan, it actually decreases the amount that students at 4-year state colleges get, at least to a certain extent. Why the focus on a 2-year college, a community college, instead of giving students a scholarship to a 4-year university?
Well, excellent question. And I think that says something about a realistic assessment of Tennessee as a state. We have workforce needs now, but projected in the future, that are going to require the kind of skills that are more those that you acquire at a community college or a TCAT. We call them Tennessee College of Applied Technology. Also, the type of students that we're trying to better serve, so we increase the base of better educated Tennesseans, are first generation and low income students. And again, community colleges, as well as the TCATs, are types of institution that really serve the needs of those students.
And does a student have to go to a certain kind of community college? What if they would rather go to a trade school?
Well, in Tennessee, we have community colleges, 13 statewide, and then we have 27 colleges of applied technology statewide. And then this program also applies to students who enroll in associate degrees. There are a couple of public universities that do offer associate degrees and 12 of the private universities.
I understand that this is going to cost, estimated to cost about $34 million a year. I also understand most of that money, much of it comes from the state lottery. I wonder if you're prepared for educating students who then move elsewhere to get a job.
Well, that would happen. But as far as public policy, I think it's still a public good to have better educated your citizens. Back to the way this is being funded, again, this is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but the lottery scholarship itself had accrued a huge reserve, $300 million plus or minus. That is now being moved into a trust, which the interest and earnings of which will support this Tennessee Promise program. So no new funding was required. Any the difference between what's required and what the trust generates will be paid for with support from the lottery, but no new state dollars are necessary.
Not everyone, not every lawmaker, I should say, in Tennessee is on board. State Senator Joey Hensley said, quote, "I think we're giving away free college to people who are not prepared for college." What's your response to that? I have to imagine that as you're paying for free tuition, some people won't make it through 2 years. Some people will drop out after a semester or 1 year.
Well, that's true, and that has been the case. There are some things we've actually been preparing for this for some time. There have been great improvements in the high school curriculum in preparing students to be college-ready, career-ready. On the higher education side, through some initiatives 4 years ago, we've doing a far better job articulating the needs of and identifying transfer pathways, so students will be better prepared to graduate. All community colleges and universities in the state have a general education core that's universal. So there are a number of things. Remedial education is another area which ties into the big drive for 55. It's not so much a part of this Tennessee Promise, but we made some strides that I hope fewer and fewer students will fall through the cracks.
I mean, I understand the aim to get over half of Tennessee students with some form of college education, but to what end? I assume that if somebody's going to community college, maybe they get an associate's degree. What is the state actually hoping that results in?
Right. Well, 55, that's the actual number, the percent of jobs projected in the year 2025 that will require a post-secondary credential. So that's where that number comes from. But beyond that, you know, the criticism or the comment like, well, there's more to being better educated than having a job. And that's true. But at this particular time, as a state, where we are with our history and our economy, it really does need to be more direct ties to the needs of the workforce.
Richard Rota is Executive Director of the Tennessee Higher Education Commission. He joined us from Nashville. Richard, thank you so much and good luck.
Well, thank you.
Now we want to take a closer look at women who work full-time as stay-at-home moms. We have new numbers from the Pew Research Center that show the proportion of stay-at-home moms in the U.S. has gone up since 1999. That number had been declining since the 1960s, but between 1999 and 2012, the percentage of moms who stayed at home rose from 23% to 29%. Joining us to talk about this is Devera Cohn. She's a senior writer at the Pew Research Center and an author of the new report. Devera, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the increase, what was causing the decrease in stay-at-home moms?
Well, there was a real march into the workplace among all women, but including mothers. The first ones to join the workforce were women with older children. But then, as time went by, even mothers of children younger than six joined the workforce, and the workforce was eager to have them for many years.
And I had thought that at a certain point we reached the tipping point where you kind of needed the two-income family to a certain extent.
That's certainly something that people say. But other scholars talk about how women were brought up, as certainly women with college educations, now assume that they'll work and have careers. And so even if the income isn't a factor, many want to work.
So this increase in stay-at-home moms, is it among college-aged women?
Actually, no. That's the interesting thing. Overall, stay-at-home moms are less educated than working moms. So the higher share of high school grads and women without a high school diploma are home than among college grads. So only about one in five college graduates is a stay-at-home mom versus about half of women who don't even have a high school diploma.
What's keeping them home? Why are they making the decision, whereas in years past they would have gone out to get a job? Why are they now choosing to stay home?
We think it's a very complicated decision, and of course it's personal to every woman, and many of the factors might be emotional and not, as the economists would like to think, rational. But what we've seen is an uptick in the share of stay-at-home moms who say they're there not because they're caring for home and family, but because they can't find a job, about 6% in 2012 versus 1% in 2000. That's especially true among women without a college degree. We also think some of it's demographic. There are certain groups where there are higher proportions of stay-at-home moms. I'm thinking especially of immigrants, Latina women, and Asian Americans. And those groups are growing as a share of the population. So if they have a preference or an inclination to be at home, that will drive the numbers as well.
Well, we reached out to our listeners on Facebook about this report, and we actually spoke with Sasha Hedick. She's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She said she considered going back to work but couldn't afford it. Here's what she said.
I just looked at the job prospects, and it seemed that with the cost of daycare, with the fuel expenses, that I would probably have to get a second car. I would basically be working in order to pay for the resources that allowed me to work.
That was a common complaint even when I was in my 20s. What's tipping the balance now? Is it because of the recession?
Well, there's a couple things. We did look at the cost of childcare, and it has gone up in inflation-adjusted terms, in real dollars, over time. And of course, it hits especially hard as a percentage of income among women who have lower income. So there's some income groups where as much as 40% of what you make might go to childcare. Now, you might also be eligible for a subsidy, but the point is it's going to be a harder job for you to make enough money to cover that childcare.
We also spoke with Allie Bender, and she is a Harvard grad, so clearly college-educated, probably expensively college-educated. She lives in Coral Springs, Florida, and she said she felt conflicted about deciding to stay at home when her daughter was 10 months old. Take a listen.
Not a lot of my college friends were home with kids. They were all doing really exciting things in the corporate world or working for nonprofits, and I felt a little bit like an underachiever in some ways that I had spent all this time and money and energy on my 2 degrees, and then I wasn't really using them in the traditional sense of the word. But at the same time, I felt like I was making such a difference to my daughter.
Is there growth in those kind of decisions, choosing to stay home because you feel like that's a better thing for your children?
Well, we don't have a lot of data. The data we do have show that when women are asked why they're not in the workplace, a shrinking share say they're home to care for home and family. That's certainly true of a majority of single stay-at-home moms. But we're finding that even among married stay-at-home moms with working husbands, that a shrinking share say they're home to care for home and family, and a growing share are home because they can't find a job, they're ill or disabled or enrolled in school.
Let me give you some more statistics from a government agency, in this case the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and they found recently that women with children under the ages of 18 earn less than women without children, while men with kids earn more than men without kids. And in fact, women generally make less money for every child they have, even after you account for factors like taking time off for childbearing and career choice. To what extent does this play into it, that you have to calculate for the fact that as a female, you're going to make less if you have kids?
And even if there weren't some unexplained portion that people think could be due to things like discrimination, the fact is, if you're stepping back from the workplace, either for part-time work or being out of the workplace, you're going to lose money anyway. You know, it's interesting. We surveyed women, or parents anyway, and asked, have you ever stepped back, reduced your hours, or taken time off to care for a child or family member? And a fairly hefty proportion said they had, I think, about 4 in 10 moms. And then we asked, did you regret that decision in any way, even though it may have cost you some money? And the answer overwhelmingly was no.
What do we know about the difference in outcomes, or do we? When you look at these statistics and you say the number of stay-at-home moms is going up, what does that tell us about family units and children?
Well, you can look at it from how many children are being cared for by different types of moms, and certainly compared with, say, 1970, we still have a smaller share being cared for by moms at home or dads at home. And we find that the American public is a little conflicted about this, that although there's overall support for working women and working mothers, the American public does think it makes it harder to raise a child if a mom is in the workplace. And when we asked, is a child better off with a parent at home or just as well off if both parents work, 60% of the public said a child is better off with one parent at home.
The pendulum could swing the other way, right? If the recession turns around, if jobs get more plentiful, if women start to make that calculation and realize they can make more in the workplace than staying at home and not paying for daycare, this pendulum could swing back the other way.
Well, we do find that most women say they'd like to work either full-time or part-time. So I don't think that we'll see the share of moms at home rise to a perhaps even the number that it, the share that it was in 1970, when about half of moms were at home. There is a preference for part-time work. People would like to try to make it balance out a little better than they might be able to with a full-time job. But even most stay-at-home moms, we find, say they would prefer to work either part-time or full-time.
Last question for you. What about stay-at-home dads?
Yeah, this is a very interesting topic, and stay tuned. I think we'll be doing more work on this. We think that that number has gone up. We did a little bit of analysis and found that about 6% of dads who are married or have a partner are at home with their children. And we'd like to take a closer look at who they are and why they're there.
Devera Cohn, senior writer for the Pew Research Center. She was with us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Devera, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, the recent Heartbleed bug had a lot of people rethinking their online safety. But more and more, it's big businesses that have been big targets for hackers stealing data for ransom. We'll find out more about the hackers and how businesses are protecting themselves. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights at ajws.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Hari Kondabolu.
I used to do a bit where I used to read the U.S. citizenship application on stage. There were questions about, like, whether you were affiliated with a terrorist organization, which is like, why would you even click yes?
He was a writer and correspondent for W. Kamau Bell's TV series. He has a new comedy album. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. This week, I'll be joined by guest panelists Dyke Barkley, Bill Vanderwhite, and Teresa Mears. We'll offer advice for the spring gardening season, and we'll be answering your calls and emails live on the air. Join us for Mid-American Gardener Thursday night at 7 on WILL-TV, or listen Saturday morning at 6:30 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. You might have been hearing about the Heartbleed bug over the past couple weeks, and if you haven't, you might want to check it out. It's important. That is the security flaw that researchers say could have compromised up to 500,000 websites. So maybe you changed your passwords for your online accounts by now. But Heartbleed got us thinking here. What other kinds of threats are out there that we don't entirely know about, and what can you do to protect yourself from them? We have Jerry Smith with us now to answer those questions. He's a technology reporter for the Huffington Post, and he joins us from our New York bureau. Jerry, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the cyber threats that we're hearing more and more about recently is ransomware. And I wonder if it appears differently. Ransomware, when it occurs, what is it? And how does it appear to, say, an individual as opposed to a company?
Yeah, ransomware really takes two forms. For the individual computer user, it's essentially a virus that shows up on your computer if you click on a bad link or visit a malicious website. And it'll be a pop-up on your screen, and it often will purport to be from, say, the FBI, and it'll say that you've been looking at illegal pornography or piracy, and to avoid any kind of law enforcement action, you need to pay such and such amount of money. It can range from a couple $100 to a couple $1,000. But what that does is it essentially locks you out of your computer, and you don't have access to any of the files on there. But what we're seeing more and more is actually there's another sort of cyber extortion that's happening to companies. There's been a few technology startups in recent weeks that have said that they've been extorted by hackers. And it's a little bit of a different attack where suddenly their website or their online service will crash, will get knocked offline, and then employees at the company will get an email from an unidentified hacker saying, essentially, I just crashed your website and I'll do it again unless you pay me.
Does it work? Do some of these companies pay?
Well, the companies that have gone public, there's not too many of them, but they said that they didn't pay. And the reason they said they didn't pay was because if they did, even if it was just a couple $100, they're afraid that they would essentially have a target on their back and that hackers would tell other hackers that these people, they're willing to pay, so you should go after them. And experts say that you should never pay a hacker ransom, that you should go to law enforcement or contact a computer security company that offers a service that can essentially help you out in that situation. But there has been research done that shows that some people do pay. It's maybe as little as 3% of victims will actually pay the ransom. But that can actually add up to a lot of money for the hackers because they're going after thousands and thousands of computer users. And so even if it's just a couple $100, if enough people pay, that's a pretty good source of revenue for the computer hackers.
But how accurate is our data? Do we know how many companies have been targeted? Are they letting us know when this happens?
Right. I mean, the statistics are kind of hard to come by because most people who have this happen to them don't say anything, especially if you end up paying a hacker. A company is very reluctant to disclose that publicly. But security company Symantec actually did a study last year where their estimate is that maybe 3% of victims actually pay.
Is there anything that requires security problems, privacy problems, that requires a company to let us know if our personal information on that website is in danger?
Yeah, there's actually laws in almost every state that require companies to disclose if they've been hacked. And there's actually federal legislation right now that's being considered that would make it nationwide. Because oftentimes companies, when they've been hacked, they take a few weeks to investigate. Whether how many people have been affected or whether their customers have been affected. And then sometimes companies never say that they've been hacked at all because they have stock prices and reputations to uphold. And sometimes their lawyers will say, you should stay quiet about this because we may be facing some lawsuits. But there is more of a push now for these companies to be more open. I know that they're also being asked to disclose whether they've had any kind of cybersecurity incident in their SEC filing. So there's a push to have these companies be a lot more transparent about when they're under any kind of threat from hackers.
Let's bring this back to individuals. I mean, needless to say, if your computer gets locked up and supposedly FBI tells you to send a money order for a couple grand, don't do it. But what are some of the other things that are showing up that are a danger to someone, especially through email?
Yeah, I mean, email is, I mean, it's actually a very common hacker technique called spear phishing, where you'll get an email that looks a lot like a friend or family member or any kind of trusted source, but it's not. It's a hacker who's impersonating that person, and oftentimes they'll have an attachment or a link embedded in that email, and if you click on it, it allows that hacker to essentially take over your computer. And if you work at a company, that hacker can jump from your computer to some of the other employees' computers and steal data from that company. So, I mean, that's really, you know, email is a very common way that people are getting taken advantage of. You know, there's also just websites that if you go to that website, you don't even have to click on anything on that website. But the website itself is booby-trapped, and you'll, you know, just by visiting it, you'll have your computer will be infected with malicious software.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but if I'm running my virus scans and malware scans regularly, am I pretty safe?
You know, I mean, that's a good idea. I mean, some of the other things that, you know, experts will say is use complex passwords, not just 123456, but use words and numbers and letters. Use different passwords for each site. A lot of popular sites now will use what's called two-factor authentication, where you not only have to type in a password, but you also get a second password sent to your phone. That way, a hacker, even if they steal their password, they can't get into your account unless they also have access to your phone.
It just gets more complicated all the time, Jerry. Jerry Smith is a technology reporter for the Huffington Post. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Rap and hip-hop have been around for decades, of course. They've now become one of America's most successful cultural exports. But you might be surprised to learn that only 5 songs and albums from those genres are represented in the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry.
1989, the number, another summer. A child is born with no state of mind, blind to the ways of mankind. God is smiling on you, but he's frowning too.
I said a hip hop, the hip to the hip hip hop. You don't stop the rocker to the bang bang boogie. Say up jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat.
Oh, I'm some nigga and I reminisce, cause through the drama I can always depend on my mama.
When it comes to being Baylor, it's just me, myself, and I.
Every year, the Library of Congress adds recordings to the registry that they say are important to America's culture and history. This year, 25 new recordings were added. None of them were hip-hop, though. Joining us to talk about it is William Boone. He's a professor in the English and African American Studies Department at Winston-Salem State University and founder of Afro Blue Media. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going, Celeste?
Good. You know, I wonder, first of all, before we get started on the hip-hop not being included this year, we just heard the message from Grandmaster Flash, Rapper's Delight with the Sugar Hill Gang, of course, Fear of a Black Planet, Public Enemy, Dear Mama from Tupac Shakur, and 3 Feet High and Rising De La Soul. Any problem with those?
No. I actually, I think these are very, very, very good selections in that they represent a broad sort of scope of hip-hop music. So I don't have a problem with what the registry has included. I guess my problem is what they've excluded.
So I should say that the Library of Congress responded when we reached out to them and said, quote, "The National Recording Registry really does represent all facets of America's soundscape and its rich diversity. Nominations are gathered through online submissions from the public and the National Recording Preservation Board, which is comprised of leaders in the fields of music, recorded sound, and preservation," unquote. So, William Boone, your response, I assume if you had been on this recording preservation board, you have ideas on what you would have added. What would you have included this year?
Wow, that's a great question. There's a couple albums that I think would really better represent not only American musical culture, but the hip-hop generation. I don't see how they could omit Run DMC. Feel as though Run DMC is not only a seminal group, but they are archetypal in their approach to hip-hop music, particularly their 1985 album King of Rock, where they merge hip-hop and rock sensibilities.
So if they're collecting things that are historically relevant, and in a way it's almost like they're creating a time capsule for people, I kind of think of it. What are the qualities that a song or an album needs to have to make it onto that? I mean, obviously, the things that you study may not be the things that somebody in the National Registry might consider important, right? They're not hip-hop scholars. They're trying to create a large picture.
Right. Well, I would say that I think the music should be representative of a given era or a given region. So, for example, Nas's Illmatic. Illmatic had such a profound impact on not only the New York sound and hip-hop sound, But in terms of the topics that were covered within hip hop, so, you know, I think at the very least these songs, these albums should be representative of a certain era, a certain moment, a certain cultural moment.
Rappers are monkey flipping with the funky rhythm. I be kicking, musician, inflicting composition. A pain, I'm like Scarface, sniffing cocaine, holding an M16. See with the pin, I'm extreme. Now, bullet holes left.
I wonder, to what extent should a song that's included also be popular? Does something that's really important have to be popular? Does it have to reach a certain number of people before it becomes a historical artifact?
Not necessarily, because I think we have to be careful there as we walk the tightrope between, say, popular music and art, if you will. So I wouldn't necessarily say it had to be popular, but I would say that I would judge it more by impact. So another album that I hope makes it onto the registry is 50 Cent's Get Rich or Die Trying. And so there's popular success there, but not only did 50 Cent's narratives impact the way hip-hop artists dealt with realism, 50 Cent has had a profound impact on the business landscape. So in that regard, I think it should perhaps be, the impact should be multidimensional, multi-layered.
Let me put it to you this way. Let's say that I'm on the board and I'm helping to choose what the 25 archival recordings will be, right? And we have to include great political statements, right? Maybe we're going to include something from the Mandela Memorial. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're going to include something else that marks a moment in time. And say that there's a few spots left, you kind of have to include all of music. And yes, hip hop is ubiquitous, but an argument could be made that you have to put in Let It Go from Frozen. That's pretty ubiquitous also. And you're laughing, but it's everywhere.
Right. 2 points. One, I think hip hop emerges in an era of skepticism. So I think that's important to note. And so,
wait, could you explain a little further what you mean? It emerges in an era of skepticism.
Yes,
what
yes.
Does
so,
that mean?
So in the 1980s, you know, hip hop was viewed, and actually all the way up into the 90s, as sort of this disposable, ephemeral art form. Okay, it won't last. These are just kids. You know, this is not important. And so, you know, hip hop has, since its inception, been kind of pushing back on these dominant narratives. You know, we're here to stay, essentially. You know, so you fast forward some 40 years later, and it's still here, and it doesn't seem to be fading away. So I think there's a bit of maybe generational bias there, a bit out of touch as it relates to the pulse of American culture.
And we should also point out that if you're going to go onto the Library of Congress list, the song or selection has to be at least 10 years old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That would bring us right now, obviously it's 2014, so that would bring us up to 2004. So what did we miss from the early 2000s? That you think is most important for us to get in there? You mentioned Run DMC, you mentioned Nas. What else are we missing? Do we need to get Jay-Z in there?
I'm not sure if we can include Jay-Z, but clearly he's made an impact. I would answer that yes, but before we talk about Jay-Z, I think we have to talk about the precursors to Jay-Z. Somebody like a group like A Tribe Called Quest. And again, I think that's the significance of hip-hop, and that it's bricolage. It brings a lot of different elements together to create a sort of a narrative. So A Tribe Called Quest's first album, People's Instinctive Travels and the Paths of Rhythm. They come together to create essentially a new sound. And a new American sound, because jazz, as we know, is an American art form.
Bonita, Bonita, Bonita.
And then also, I would maybe include Outkast, you know, because there's always a sort of New York-centric bias in hip-hop. And so the South is usually excluded. So I would definitely have to include Outkast, Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music 1994 album, because, again, it made a national impact within the genre, but then also outside of the genre, as Andre 3000 has moved on into film and various other avenues and arenas.
Yeah, even animated cartoon shows for kids.
Yes.
What do you think hip-hop will tell future generations? Eventually, the genre will either evolve into something completely different or disappear in one way or another. So, you know, 100 years from now, looking back, the same way that we look back at Scott Joplin's Rags, what do we learn about our culture by listening to these hip-hop songs?
Well, I think the first thing that we'll remember looking back, as we look back at our historical memory, I think we have to come to grips with the fact that America is still struggling with certain things, whether it be race, whether it be poverty, whether it be violence. And so I think hip-hop offers an exciting opportunity to look back on these moments and not only chronicle history and culture in America and the tension between generations and communities, I think it's also a great American story in regards to the way young black folk, young poor folk, folk of color in America are grappling with these things, commercialism, hyper-consumption. These are things that are not only central to young people, but central to the American experience.
And what, having hip-hop included and rap included at all on the Library of Congress, does that make a difference to what you were talking about earlier in terms of the skepticism surrounding this genre?
Yes.
Does it matter?
Yes. I don't want to paint the Library of Congress as a villain, because I think they've done a good job. I just think they're a bit out of touch. I mean, these things can happen when we're talking about institutions that go back 200 or 300 years. I think it is commendable, but there's more work to do, if you will.
Message from William Boone to the Library of Congress: get with the times. William Boone is professor in the English and African American Studies Department at Winston-Salem State University, and he joined us from that campus. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Celeste. Have a good one.
But I move just like Lou Brock with speed. I'm agile, plus I'm worth your while. 100% intelligent black child.
And that's our program for today. I'm Celeste Headlee, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Tune in for more talk tomorrow.
You'll be crazy sad and alone. Industry rule number 4080. Record company people are shady. So kids, watch your back, cause I think they smoke crack. I don't doubt it. Look at how they act. Look off to better things like a hip-hop forum. Pass me the rock and I'll score them with the quorum and proper. What you say, hammer? Proper. Rap is not pop. If you call it that, then stop.